Thanks, Tino. I'm going to try and fill in a little bit more data, more specifically dealing with what we're dealing with on the stink bug in from Georgia. So all of my data is going to be collected from the Georgia habitat. To bring you up to speed, in contrast to some of the data that Scott had talked about from the Mid-South, in Georgia, we're looking generally about 1 to 1.5 million acres, and that's spread across a lot of very small fields. Now, that's important because we're dealing with a lot of border ecotones. We're dealing with a lot of adjacent crops, and I think that has a lot to do with potential movement among these crops and perhaps movement of these pathogens within that system. Our growers typically rotate among peanuts, soybeans, small grains, corn. And we've got a lot of planted pines in our system. We've got a great deal of vegetables. Those have certainly made large inroads into our production systems. Peaches, pecans, and tobacco. So the take-home message here is that we're a very diverse agricultural cropping system. And I'm going to be using the term farmscape, and I would define that as being the within-farm configuration of resource patches. And resource patch in this particular context is going to be any place where stink bugs can feed within that farmscape. And that includes both the cultivated hosts as well as the non-cultivated hosts. And from the literature, we know that stink bugs can feed on more than 200 different hosts. To bring you up to speed very briefly on stink bug biology, our stink bugs emerge in the early spring, and that's actually spread out for a fairly long duration, as early January, depending on weather conditions, but certainly by February, we start seeing a few in crimson clover, mustards, those sorts of things, and that goes clear on through March and into early April, and we start seeing things come out of diapause. And they're feeding on early developing agronomic crops, and in Georgia, that can be some vegetables, and they're going after seeds and developing fruits. Those populations continue to reproduce and increase until we have our late planted crops like cotton and soybeans when we see a great deal of damage. The current situation in Georgia then looks like this, and Jeremy laid it out very eloquently. Stink bugs are an economic issue for Georgia cotton production, and we've got to be able to tackle this head on. Brown stink bugs in particular are tolerant of pyrethroid insecticides. Now that's got implications for the type of chemistries that we use to manage these bugs, and then there's some compounding effects, like if we have to dig deeper into the toolbox, if we can't use the pyrethroid, then we have to dig back to the older chemistry, to the OPs, and then we risk potential secondary pest outbreaks. So the species composition, the timing, all these sorts of issues are really critical in the way that we're managing stink bugs. From my perspective as a research entomologist, here's really the way I see the issues, and this is what I'm concerned about in my particular position. Georgia growers, our scouts, and our consultants have got to be able to accurately estimate our insect populations and know the species composition in order to make informed decisions. And so all the data that I'm going to show you today is sort of developed around this idea that we want to be able to make informed decisions. And that's in response to our economic thresholds, and Jeremy had talked about how those have been developed. The particular insecticide that we choose, what chemistry class that's going to come from, when are these effective, what's the ideal use for each of these compounds, the timing of those applications, we don't want to be putting out excessive applications, and then follow-up for efficacy type assessments. It doesn't make any sense for us to put out an insecticide if we can't follow it up a week later and say, did we indeed see a decrease in the population or not? And so for each of these reasons, we've developed very clear sampling programs. For this audience, I'll throw in the additional question, and that's not one that we've honestly done a great job looking at in the past, and that's how does this incidence of boll rot pathogens affect our treatment guidelines? For purposes of this talk, I'm going to look at three research questions in particular. What type of damage do our stink bugs cause? And this is, again, looking specifically at the Southeast. How can we improve the profitability of cotton production by managing these pests? And finally, is there evidence that stink bugs can indeed transmit boll rot pathogens and we see decreases in productivity as a result of that? Well, the first question is pretty easy to answer, and we've got a number of years of data on that. These are some pictures that came out of my lab within the last year. Probably the most important picture I'm going to show you today is the undamaged boll. We've got to have some kind of a baseline. Can we separate bolls that have been damaged from those that have not been damaged? So in this case, we've got this clean, pale white, green appearance. There's no probing. That's clearly a boll that's been undamaged. And so our sampling methodology at this point, and I'm almost embarrassed to say as an entomologist, the state of the art right now is we go pull these bolls out and we crush them in our hands. And we sit there and we look at them visually and say, all right, what do we see? That's as far as we've gotten. If the bowl has been punctured within the past 12 to 24 hours, we see these little feeding punctures, and this is typical. This also tells you a little bit more about stink bug behavior. They're not able to detect the seeds that they're going after with one single probe. We tend to see clusters of probes, and that suggests that they're going after finding that particular seed. And once in a while, they hit it right on the button first time. A lot of times you see clusters of these things at different points on the bowls. If you pull apart the lint, and this would be in a bowl that's, say, 10 to 15 days old, 2 weeks approximately, if the stink bug has hit a seed, you see this lint staining. That's very characteristic of a bowl that's been hit by stink bugs. 24 to 48 hours after that bowl has been hit, then we get these callus growths. We tend to call that a wart. We think it's an immune response by the plant. And if indeed that stink bug was successful in transmitting what I'm going to call a bowl rot pathogen, and my goodness, that's a broad term, then we see these symptoms of bowl rot. If you look at an individual bowl, this is the different locks and carpels from one single bowl. You can see in the upper right there, there's obviously something going on in cross-section. There's some individual feeding marks on here. Those, we don't know whether this is the same bug. Was this different bugs? You know, there's a lot of different questions we can go at with this. And then the individual locks that come out of there, this staining matches very well with where that particular mark is. And so we tend to see these sorts of symptoms. And as we move over to the left here, you can see in this particular lock, there appears to have been the introduction of some sort of a bowl rot pathogen. Looking at the relationship between fiber quality and stink bug damage, we've been able to establish some very clear and definite relationships, but we haven't looked at this with the pathogen component. So this is some data that came out of my lab the last 2 years, and I would add that the last 2 years have been characterized by particularly low pathogen loads. And so I feel like this is very direct stink bug damage that we're talking about here. In this particular graph, we're looking at cotton that was planted adjacent to three different crops, corn, peanuts, or soybeans. This is a replicated trial across three different locations in 2 years. I'm looking at season average bowl damage, and you see that as we move into the field, our percent damage decreases. Now, these are means, of course. It's not to say that there's no stink bugs in the center of the field, but talking in terms of generalities, when that cotton is located against peanuts or soybeans, we're averaging 70% damage. And that very definitely indicates that we've got stink bug populations in some of these other crops, or at least it looks that way, and we've done some mark and recapture to show this a little bit more fully. And as you move into the field, and these are looking at means again, this is not an end-all type analysis, that damage tends to decrease. Conversely, when you look at seed cotton, then we go in and harvest these plots. When we look right along the edges, it makes sense if we've got a lot of damage here, we're actually going to see large decreases in seed cotton yield. And so that's what we're showing again, is that against those crops where we know we have reproduction, we see large decreases, and as you move into the field, that improves. One of the surprises to me then was to take that seed cotton that we'd harvested from those various geographic locations in cotton fields, gin it through the microgin, and what are we getting there? On gin turnout, and that would be the proportion of saleable lint that comes out of there, there's a large decrease in the amount of lint per unit of seed cotton that we feed into the gin when the cotton comes from these areas that were heavily damaged. Well, I think looking at it in a little bit more hindsight, that makes sense because those bowls are not fluffing the way we would expect them to. And so when it goes through the saws, we're taking a larger proportion of the lint with the seed. But the take home is you've got less yield to deal with in terms of your sellable product. The last thing that we did, since we have the yield and we've got all the fiber quality, we classed these samples. And as you might guess, the economic value of those samples from regions of the field with large amounts of stink bug damage are about half what they are from regions where we had less damage. From a sampling perspective, we want to be able to make very straightforward predictions about how much damage do we see and how much is that going to cost us in yield at the end of the year. So this is a data set that we developed this year, and I'm very pleased that we see a nice linear relationship in here where we can look at the percentage of bowls that show some sort of damage, and there's a linear relationship with the number of locules on a per bowl basis that show damage. What this is telling us is as the percentage of bowls that are damaged increase, each individual bowl is going to show additional feeding as well. This is a nice linear relationship. This is the sort of thing that we can build sampling programs around. This is a very quick overview of some of the sampling threshold work, and a lot of this is Jeremy's in terms of the conceptual part of this, but many of the Southeastern entomologists have come together on this, and to make really efficient use of my time here, I've summarized 3 years worth of work and 23 trials on one slide. Jeremy can take credit for that. But what we're looking at here to try and explain this is if you don't spray, it would be this particular bar here, and then looking at the different thresholds, and this really gets to the question that was posed earlier about what are your different types of thresholds for where you're putting out sprays and what difference does that make. So in this particular case, that would be spraying weekly at bloom. You do see an increase if you spray weekly of about 67 pounds over the untreated. Remember, this is means across 23 trials, a wide range of conditions, different states, different cultivars, and those sorts of things. But if you take that increase in lint yield and you subtract out the cost of production, by the time you put out 6.5 sprays, economically you're losing money. That's not a great position for our growers to be in. So we looked at other types of thresholds. In this particular case, we'd be looking at a 10%. So when we go out, we look at an aggregate sampling proposal across the entire field. If you've got 10% damage on those fields, we sprayed not quite 2 times on average. We did see a slight increase in yield, but we still lost money economically. Looking at the 20%, and that's where our threshold had been up until the past year, we didn't spray as often, but those were very well-timed applications. And that's the critical point here is when you put out that insecticide application, how do you maximize the effect of, or the effort that you're putting out there? We actually made money on that spray. Then when we lit to a 30%, we're actually missing a lot of damage, and we just don't treat it in time. I think the more exciting result here is the new dynamic approach, and that's where we're more aggressive with spraying damage during weeks of bloom where we know that's really where we're making the bulk of our crop. So we're less aggressive with spraying early in, during bloom and less aggressive late in the bloom cycle because we're not adding a great deal to that proportionally to what we would be adding in the middle of the season. So this is what happens when we're just managing stink bugs. We're able to do that very, very well. However, if you go back and look at our production acreage in Georgia and look at the estimates for the number of bales that we've lost directly attributed to stink bugs, it doesn't exactly flow like you would expect it to. And so I pulled this directly out of Mike Williams' presentations, and Philip Roberts has been developing these data on an annual basis. This would be our production acreage, the black circles. So we've averaged somewhere between about 1 million and 1.5 million acres. By year, and you would expect that the number of bales that we've lost, or estimated bales, would be fairly parallel to what's going on there. The two anomalies in this case will be 2003 and 2005, in which cases the number of bales that we've lost have greatly exceeded what we would expect based on the prevailing data. And so those are cases where I'm going to argue right now, I think we're getting additional pathogen loads within our bugs those years. And maybe that's something that we need to be taking into account when we set up our sampling thresholds. One of the ways that we're dealing with this, and there's a number of studies that I'd like to talk about, but I'm going to just do a quick overview of one that's going on right now, is looking at this in a farmscape context. We're no longer trying to manage entirely based on fields. So this is a 402-acre study area that I've got, and Jeremy and Francis Ray Jones are also working on this project. We've all got our own little farmscapes. We're sampling these with a grid basis. Everything is GPS coordinated. We're also looking at the borders or areas in here where we've got very fine scale sampling in there. So each bug that comes out of this study, we can tell you exactly what day it came out and the latitude, longitude where that particular bug was captured, how far into the cotton it was. And in my lab, what we're doing then is saying, okay, this came out of cotton, this one came out of some kind of a small grain, this happens to be a rotation, this was wheat followed up by something later on. We've got soybeans in here, got a pecan orchard up here on the far northern end. We've also got watermelons in the system. And we're looking at each of those bugs individually, sending those to Geno and saying, okay, let's cage these bugs on developing cotton bolls and look at the incidence of boll rot on a per crop, on a per time frame type basis. So this is really as cutting edge as we have right now. I would love to tell you all the pathogens that are involved, and I think Geno has an opportunity to get into that a little bit more. But really the striking factor for me on this was, okay, in this case we're looking at July corn samples. These are southern green stink bugs. Of the 34 bugs that went into this, each of those being caged on an individual boll, nearly 80% of those showed signs of damage in the boll. But the striking factor for me was that over half of those showed symptoms of disease. And so what that tells us is that perhaps there's much more disease out there than we've been able to, or at least attributed in the past. And I think this is an area where we really need to be putting some emphasis on Can we detect these pathogens in the bugs early on, and do we need to make adjustments to the thresholds at different times? The good thing is in corn, for example, we have a lot of stink bugs in corn early on. That's long before they appear into our cotton. We don't start seeing stink bugs in cotton, at least in Georgia, in most cases, till mid to late July. Can we make predictions based on the pathogen load here such that we could adjust our thresholds here? In terms of a brief discussion then of sort of the data that I've been working on, very clearly, based on the literature and the work that Gino's doing, stink bugs are transmitting boll rot pathogens into developing cotton bolls. And to my knowledge, we've got a bacterium as well as a yeast, and there may be others within that suite of pests, and that's a general area. The observational data that I showed certainly suggests that pathogen incidence is highly variable across years and across fields, and that's where Jeremy's crystal ball really comes into effect. It's tough for us to predict that, but we'd love to have the ability. We really don't know how different stink bug species and host crops affect pathogen dispersal. That's something we'd like to get on. We do have georeferencing for all of these bugs, and so we may be able to put some crude analysis on that in the near future. And then the part that I would throw out there is we've developed very tight sampling thresholds that work very well. I mean, we've shown that with empirical data that what we're doing right now works well. The one issue in my mind, though, is much of that data was developed the last 3 years, and we haven't had large pathogen content, if you look back on that historical data, the last 3 years. If we'd done this work in 2003 and 2005, I think we'd have a measure of variability that would be very interesting to look at there. All right, that's going to wrap up my portion of the talk here. I certainly want to acknowledge that this is not all my data. We've got a great deal of collaborating growers, consultants, county agents, and a number of scientists from our land-grant institutions. And I certainly want to acknowledge funding by USDA, the Georgia Cotton Commission, as well as Cotton Incorporated in keeping us going on some of these issues. So thanks very much.
Have a good time.
Yeah, in the back there. I'm an entomologist. I talk in great generality here. Based on what I understand from the literature, we're dealing with a bacterium, we're dealing with a yeast. We think that it's more of a mechanical transmission, whereas these pathogens are actually harbored within the stylet. They're not circulating through the entire body, although Gino may talk about some of these issues in a little bit more detail. But right now, what I would say is it's more of a mechanical issue. We've just got mechanical transmission. Yeah, Mike. I don't have that data directly looking at field bolls, but what I can tell you is that in my own insect colony, when I cage lab-reared southern green stink bugs, I don't get boll rot. I get warts, I get stain lint, I get damage symptoms. When I collect bolls from the field, then I get boll rot. So where that's coming from and what the baseline amount is on a given year under given environmental conditions, that's a big black box, but it's a great question. I'm going to defer to Gino on that. I think he's probably going to talk about that in the next talk.
Anyone else?
Yeah, let me ask a question. If you've got a cage situation and you don't have insects and you do sterilize and it will function to hold the disease, or is the organism in the gut of the insect like a virus transmitted?
To the best of my knowledge, what we're dealing with, in at least in the majority of the cases here, this is not a case where we have like a plasmodium that circulates within the mosquito. We're looking at something that's acquired, it stays in the mouth parts, and it's just mechanically moved from bowl A to bowl B in successive feeding. So it's a little bit of a different case than the traditional, you know, insect vector relationship that we see in medical veterinary entomology.
Excellent. Thank you very much.